And good morning. Welcome to Hour 2 of Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson, the producer for the show. Jason Croft at the controls this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for Hour Number 1. The most important battles in the War of 1812 took place in the Atlantic Ocean, in the Great Lakes, and in the southern part of the United States. It is also true, though, that the war touched the land that would eventually become the state of Illinois. And in this hour of focus, we have as our guest independent historian Gillum Ferguson, who will be talking with us about the crucial importance of the war to the development of Illinois as a state. And that is one of the things that he writes about in his recently published book, Illinois in the War of 1812. And it is published by the University of Illinois Press. I want to perhaps talk a little bit about some of the people who fought the war, at least what happened in this part of the country, review some of the events that defined it, talked about some of the lasting consequences, and questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also have an email you can write in with your questions that way, and the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Hey, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
We appreciate it. I must say I hadn't really thought about it until I started getting into the subject, but it certainly we should mention that, in fact, this year this is the bicentennial of the War of 1812. And I'm not even really sure what sort of things are planned. Is there a national bicentennial committee for the War of 1812?
There's an overall coordinating group, you might say, nationally, but the actual observances have been delegated to the states, and most of them have opted out. New York, where there was perhaps the most activity during the war, found itself just basically too broke to support a bicentennial celebration. And in our own state, with its very difficult financial situation, doesn't look like a lot is coming down the pike other than the publication of my book.
Yeah, and it is also the case that apparently this is really the first full-length treatment of what was happening in this part of the country at that time. There hasn't been anything else.
No, that's true, and that was one of the things that surprised me as I got into this. It took 200 years to write a book because there I found as I delved into it that there was really a lot of interesting stories to tell and a lot of interesting, rather colorful characters who'd passed through it. And naturally, it had quite an important step in the development of Illinois from territory to state.
Yeah. This was part of a very large, the Illinois Territory was part of a very large territory that did in fact include what is now Illinois, Wisconsin, some of Michigan, some of Minnesota. So we're really talking about a very large territory indeed.
Very large and at that time relatively empty. In that entire vast territory, over 110,000 square miles, the 1810 census counted 12,282 people, not including Indians. And the Indians themselves were rather lightly settled, probably weren't a whole lot more Indians than there were, in fact, Americans.
Yeah, so I guess the conservative estimate is that maybe, so we're talking about 10,000 or so American settlers and maybe at most twice as many Indians living here?
I would say that'd probably be a generous estimate, but yeah, I think that's in the ballpark, correct.
So we're looking at maybe a little over 30,000 people in all of the territory.
Well, yes, I think the population density was something like one tenth that of modern Alaska, but it wasn't localized throughout the territory because most of the white and black American settlers lived within 20 miles of either the lower Mississippi, the Ohio, or the Wabash Rivers. So really around the southern fringe of the state. Beyond that was the great trackless prairie, which they were rather nervous about entering.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Indians were not distributed throughout the state either. If you draw lines, say, between Springfield and Decatur and extended east and west, there were virtually no Indians, probably no more than 200-300, living south of that line. The territory was basically empty.
Yeah. As we were talking a little before we got going here, that if you had been here where we were at that point, there wouldn't have been anybody.
You'd seen the Great Prairie and, of course, occasional Indian hunting parties traveling through in search of game, and there was still some big game at that time, but it was dwindling.
Yeah. Would that we could see the Great Prairie. That would be a great experience. Well, let's talk a little bit generally about the War of 1812, because I certainly think it's the case that people have some sense of why the Revolution was important. They'll have some sense of what the Civil War meant to the United States. But if you start to ask people about, well, what do you know about the War of 1812, perhaps other than the Battle of New Orleans, I think probably most people would say, well, not much.
It was once called the Second War for American Independence, and it was a pretty good name in terms of its actual historical significance. Now it's more often referred to as the Forgotten War, which is a shame, and in hopes that what is happening during the bicentennial year will bring it somewhat back to public notice. America was nominally independent after the end of the Revolution. We had it on paper, but there's often a difference between paper and reality, and certainly most of the important countries in Europe, especially Britain and France, were treating the United States as at best a wayward stepchild, and at worst is still a colony. Mm-hmm.
And that's so we had still issues of competition and conflict, both militarily and economically, between the U.S. and Britain, and then also we had issues of British, in as the Americans would say, infringing on their rights on the high seas. So even though that war had been fought and United States, Americans would say that they had won it, there was still a big power imbalance between us and the British.
Well, definitely. And it was a problem that showed itself both on land and on sea. For about 13 years after the end of the Revolution, British troops in British forts were still occupying much of what's the Midwest, northern Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin. And we're doing it in defiance of the treaties. They're also monopolizing the Indian trade, selling them arms and ammunition, and generally trying to curry their loyalty to their great father, the King of England, George III, the same king that we had, of course, cast off. And on sea, as you pointed out, the situation was, if anything, even worse.
Mm-hmm. And I think just to round this out, I think that it has been argued, certainly can be argued, that while the United States, after the Revolutionary War, did exist, people much more, they had a regional or local kind of identification, perhaps less inclined to think of themselves as Americans. They probably still thought of themselves as, you know, Virginians, or as Massachusetts people, or as New Yorkers, or whatever, and that one of the things that the War of 1812 really did was perhaps to give Americans more of a sense of national identity.
I think that's true. It happened in a kind of a perverse way, though. The New England states at that time were dominated by a party, the Federalist Party, which was very much opposed to the war with Britain and had strong trading ties with Britain. There was, I would say, a lack of cooperation extending almost to collaboration in some cases during the War of 1812. And one of the effects was really when the United States ended with, if not a victory, at least a favorable result, it really discredited that sort of regionalism. And it did not, at least in the Northeast, rear its head again.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Gillum Ferguson, and we're talking about what was going on here in this part of the country when it was the Illinois Territory, and this was on the eve of the War of 1812, and he's written about this in his book, Illinois in the War of 1812. It is published by the University of Illinois Press. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and we have someone to talk with here in Belgium. On our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to both of you. Mm-hmm. In regards to your War of 1812, the only area of what was Illinois that really came close to any battles, I think, was right over here along the border between Indiana and Illinois. I know I'm slipping off the topic being in Indiana, but, you know, we'll have to live with that. At that time, there probably wasn't much difference between the two. Because, as you pointed out, this particular area of Illinois was completely uninhabited, mainly because it was so swampy and the grasses grew there. It was almost impassable. But in this area, wasn't it Benjamin Harrison, old Tippecanoe, that marched up along the west edge of the Wabash River, which actually goes very close to State Line, Indiana, and State Line City, Illinois, which is right north and east of Danville a little bit. And I actually, State Line City has one other amazing fact about it, that was the last place Lincoln ever saw Illinois. He gave a speech and waved goodbye and never came back alive. But if I remember right, Benjamin Harrison walked up along there to fight the Battle of Tippecanoe up near Wabash, and there was a caravan that just kind of decimated the area here because it was high enough ground along the Wabash to march along. Is that in your book?
I do discuss Battle of Tippecanoe, but rather briefly. There's been a wealth of literature about the Battle of Tippecanoe, and I didn't delve into that, though I cited to some of it, and I indicated its importance in my overall story. I was trying to tell, or to focus my efforts on, telling a story that hadn't been told before. Indeed, William Henry Harrison is who I think you're thinking of, the grandfather of President Benjamin Harrison, and himself a president for 30 days, does loom rather large, at least in the earlier part of my book, because he was in at least nominal command of the military events in both Illinois and Indiana, and then ultimately in Ohio. He never made any serious provision, though, for the defense of Illinois. He regarded it as a backwater and not terribly threatened. So really the pioneers in the Illinois Territory were left very much to their own devices in defending themselves.
Well, I was just mentioning the fact that that's as close as it came to Illinois, really, that one battle there in Tippecanoe.
Well, that's not entirely correct, because there was, in fact, besides a series of pinprick raids by Indians and by Americans in response, there was, in fact, some actual meaningful military action in Illinois. I mean, the first one would, of course, be the Fort Dearborn Massacre in Chicago, which led to the deaths of over half of the garrison and surrounding community in Chicago, albeit admittedly a small group at that time, including, for that matter, the death of Ensign George Ronan, the first graduate of West Point to be killed in action on what's now the south side, near south side of Chicago. It also led to various punitive expeditions going up the Mississippi. There was a good deal of fighting in the area of the Quad Cities. And in the Battle of Credit Island in 1814, future President Zachary Taylor was driven back by a mixed force of British red-coated soldiers and Sauk Indians, and it was forced to retreat, the only retreat under fire that Old Rough and Ready made during his entire career.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I think that it's the case that really, if you talk about, you know, the combat that took place during this time in 1812, that mostly what this was a conflict between settlers and indigenous people, between settlers and Indians. And I think that actually there weren't really many British troops. Now, this was a case where Zachary Taylor came up against British regulars in what's now the Quad Cities. But I think actually it's the case that there weren't, during this period, there really weren't very many British soldiers in the Illinois Territory, or at least in Illinois.
No, that's true. That was the only direct military action between British troops and American troops in what's now Illinois, though there were additional encounters in southwestern Wisconsin, which was then part of the territory. The Fort Dearborn Massacre, which I mentioned, was entirely an Indian affair. And, in fact, General Isaac Brock had been in planning to send messengers to Fort Dearborn to seek its surrender, not so much to gain a military advantage, just to save the lives of the garrison. In fact, turned out to be too late.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. So officially, the War of 1812 begins in June of 1812, and this event came to be called the Fort Dearborn Massacre happens in August of 1812, and it happened because here we had a fort that was really an untenable position for the people there at the fort, and so the decision was made that they and the people who were living around there should be evacuated. And there they thought they had some understanding with the Indians in the neighborhood that they would be given safe passage to, and they were going to go to Fort Wayne, which was indeed a fort, Fort Wayne, Indiana. But it didn't quite work out that way.
No, they had been ordered to evacuate by General William Hull, who is a superior officer, the commander at Ohio, at Chicago, and he had thought that the fort was indefensible. Hull had a distinguished career in the Revolution, but he'd grown old, and he was very much afraid of the Indians, and very much afraid that he would not be able to maintain his position either in Chicago or Detroit. In fact, ultimately, he surrendered Detroit to a force about half the size of his own. He ordered Captain Heald to head for Detroit by way of of Fort Wayne, there is a dispute as to whether there was some dissension at the fort, but it seems most likely that Heald's orders didn't permit him to make a decision. What he could be perhaps criticized for is waiting for a week to leave. During that time, of course, he was trying to arrange an escort. He was giving away public property to the Indians to curry their favor, but he was also destroying his ammunition and the alcohol, which may put the Indians in a very bad state of mind versus Heald and his command. So when he set off on August 15th, 1812, in fact, he led his command to disaster.
Mm-hmm. What had been previous to that, the state of relations between the American settlers and the Indians who lived around there? Had there been friction between them before?
In the Chicago area, yes. There had been some murders at a place called Lee's Place. It's now in, I guess, South Halsted Street in, I think, April of 1812. But the Indians who had perpetrated that were Winnebagoes, not from around the fort. Many of the Indians around the fort, though they may have had no particular love for Americans in general and had no particular reason to have such a feeling, had come to know the soldiers and civilians at the fort as human beings that they traded with on a daily or weekly basis. And there were relationships that were personal, and that led actually to the survival of some of those who were not, in fact, killed in the massacre. But overall, of the 100 or so civilians and soldiers who marched out of the fort, probably no more than 20 to 25 lived to return to the United States to civilization.
Yeah. Yeah. We have another caller here. Let's talk with him. Somebody calling from Robinson, and this is our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, David. Mm-hmm. I would like to point out to you and your guests that Crawford County, which is the place of Robinson, was, upon the formation of the state, went all the way up through Chicago and on up into Minnesota and the farther, but that we did have 1812 violence here in Crawford County, with the murder of a pioneer family called Hudson at the little town of Hudsonville in Crawford County, midway between Terre Haute and Vincennes, and that some of my collateral relatives were Virginians who came to Vincennes in 1809 and participated from there in the War of 1812, Tippecanoe and all that, and then shortly moved to Palestine, which was practically the only town noted on an 1820 map of Illinois. This, by the way, one of the naval battles of the Revolution took place on the Wabash just opposite Crawford County at a place called, not Quakers, but Shakertown, Indiana. I just thought I'd toss those few things in. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Well, you want to comment on that?
Well, Crawford County did have a small but important role in the Illinois War of 1812. Because it was at the end of a row of family forts and blockhouses. It began up around the present Edwardsville, descended parallel to the Mississippi south, and then across Illinois, passing through, say, Marion and Harrisburg, and then up the Wabash. And the most remote of those forts at the very end of the line was Fort Lamotte in Palestine, in Crawford County, which has been partly restored, I think still in process of being restored and very handsomely done by local historians.
Well, again, other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you like. It's will-talk, willtalk@illinois.edu. Colm Gillam Ferguson is our guest, and we're talking about what you will find in his recently published book, Illinois in the War of 1812, and it is published by the University of Illinois Press. You, I think, have argued that in some sense, we talked about, I mentioned the fact that officially war started in June of 1812. That's when the war was declared. And it was the United States who declared war on Britain, that there was an event that a year earlier in 1811 where there was apparently an Indian attack on some people in the southern part of the state, that you say that in a way that's really when things started here?
That really begins tipping the balance from peace to war, because while the incident I think you're referring to is probably the murder of Elijah Cox at a place near the present Pocahontas, not too far out in the woods, actually, there's a monument to mark the spot, built about 1900. That really began to tip the balance to show that I think war in the West was inevitable, because after that, the militia began to muster seriously and were often put into the field because at that time, Governor Edwards ordered the building of forts and fortifications throughout the southern part of the state. And in fact, many families or communities went and built their own blockhouses as well. They were clearly preparing for war. And over the next year, though, Governor Edwards was making a determined effort to try to placate the Indians and maintain the peace. It was quite clear that the slide had begun from that point.
Yeah, it seems you wonder, given as you say, that first of all, there weren't very many people, either settlers or Indians, here, that most of the Indians were living in the northern in part of what would be northern Illinois, and that most of the settlers were really living in the south, and they were living along the big rivers, which is natural to expect people to spread along the rivers, and they probably weren't all that far out of sight of the river. You would think, because there was so much open country here, maybe people couldn't plop themselves down in the middle of the high grass prairie, but that there would have been plenty of land, and that this conflict between settlers and Indians, you wonder, well, could something have been worked out so at least for a while people would have managed to coexist? Certainly there was plenty of space.
There was plenty of space, and ultimately when the Indians were expelled in the mid-1830s, the Illinois was a state and the population was growing, but it's one of the ironies I note in my book is that the state of Illinois comprises about 55,000 square miles, and there was no room in all that vast, fertile expanse that could be found for perhaps 15,000 Indians. But that being said, the Indians obviously had a different manner of living, and they required a much lower population density because they were still living very largely by hunting and gathering, though they also were engaged in agriculture not unsuccessfully. But they did require a larger area to sustain life than the more settled and agricultural white settlers.
And at that time, was it also the case that there were some questions about whether even then they could continue to live like that?
Well, there was more than a question. I would have to say that Indian society in Illinois, and what I'm saying doesn't necessarily apply to anywhere else, and I wouldn't generalize from this, but it was clearly doomed. The big game on which the Indians depended for protein and also for trade goods in the form of furs was rapidly becoming extinct, was on the way to extinction. The buffalo had virtually, but not entirely, disappeared. There was still a thriving elk trade in the Illinois River Valley up until 1820 or so, but they were in decline. Bears, other large game which Indians hunted, were disappearing rapidly. And the reason was, of course, there was an increased demand for their pelts because it was the one trade good that Indians had. And second, the Indians had an increased ability to kill them as they acquired firearms and I could use this term, modern weapons, modern of the day. Mm-hmm. So the Indian culture was really in a terrible state. The trade goods that had once been luxuries initially over the course of the 100 years preceding had become necessities, but the Indians had no ability to manufacture or produce them themselves, so they were dependent on this trade with the whites, which was, of course, help impactful perhaps in the short term, but damaging in the long term.
Yeah. So, and the Indians would have been considered officially, I suppose, allied with the British. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there were times when maybe there were some British soldiers in Illinois, but not a lot. What exactly was the relationship between the Indians who lived here and Britain?
It was, I would say, an uneasy alliance. The British had compiled a track record of betraying the expectations of the Indians, both at the end of the Revolution, where they basically abandoned them without a thought, and some of them, the tribes such as the Iroquois in New York, had fought, you know, valiantly and bloodily for on behalf of the king. And then again in the 1790s, when the United States and the Indians of the Old Northwest were at war, the British gave them the expectation that they were going to, at minimum, supply them and possibly aid the Indians. And after the Battle of Fallen Timbers in 1794, the commander at Fort Miami in northern Ohio actually shut the gates of his fort in the face of the Indians fleeing from the battlefield. So the Indians had no reason to trust the British. But under the influence, especially of their great leader Tecumseh, they were also realistic to know that they could not defeat the United States by themselves. The British had modern weapons, had some power, and had little, if any, designs on their territory.
Mm-hmm. Well, did the British encourage Indians to attack Americans?
Yes and no. The British were ambivalent about the use of Indians, clearly, and we see this through the correspondence of British leaders constantly as a constant refrain. In fact, just prior to the war, the British ambassador at Washington went so far as to warn the U.S. State Department of the dangers of an Indian uprising in the Old Northwest. But once war came, they saw the Indians as a force multiplier. On the whole long border between Canada and the United States, there are only 7,000 British soldiers to guard that territory. Most of their resources were devoted to the epic life and death struggle against Napoleonic France. So the Indians gave them a way to project power that they would not otherwise have had, but much of their interest in the Indians was in using them defensively. And one of the reasons that Illinois was not a bloodier battleground was that the British representative in this area, Indian Superintendent Robert Dixon, who's an interesting character and looms large in my book, one of his instructions was to lure as many Midwestern, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin Indians as possible eastward to join in the fight against William Henry Harrison's army in northern Ohio.
We're talking in this hour of Focus about Illinois in the War of 1812. That's the subject and also the title of Gillam Ferguson's book. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, as the anniversary of the Fukushima nuclear disaster approaches, investigative reporter Dan Edge reconstructs the crisis.
All the workers we spoke to said that, you know, after that massive earthquake, they were completely sure everything was fine because this is Japan, and nuclear power is safe in Japan. You know, this is 1 minute before the tsunami hit.
Edge's Frontline documentary is Inside Japan's Nuclear Meltdown. Join us
this afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to experience the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Choir on Thursday, March 8th. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. Tomorrow morning on the show, both hours come from the Focus archives in the first hour. The guest is the author of a book that looks at the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. The title of the book is Eisenhower, the White House Years, a show that we first broadcast in early January. Then we'll go back to last November for a conversation with Andrew Feinstein, a former member of the South African Parliament. He's also a writer, and we talked about his book, The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, back live on Thursday. And I do want to mention that in the second hour Thursday, this hour of the show on Thursday, it's our monthly show that we call Computers and You. It's a program we built into the schedule, so there'll be a regular opportunity to ask computer questions. So particularly if you have a problem, we can try to do some troubleshooting. Celeste Quinn will be the host for the show, and Deb Fleiger and Jim Eyrick will be the guests. So that's the next day or two on the program. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That is willill.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs that way. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Gillam Ferguson. He's an independent historian And he is the author of the book Illinois in the War of 1812. It is published by the University of Illinois Press. He's also contributed articles to a number of other places, including the Journal of Illinois History, the Journal of the Illinois State Historical Society, the Illinois Bar Journal, and other journals. And for many years, he worked as a state and federal prosecutor in the state of Illinois. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here is a caller to talk with in Urbana, line one. Hello.
A couple of comments. First, you don't seem to mention the fact that the Indian population had, from 1500 to 1700, fallen by at least 80%, perhaps more. By 1900, it had fallen to probably by 90%. And this was largely due to diseases introduced by the Europeans. Not purposefully, but nevertheless disastrously. And this is why much of the area in Illinois was largely depopulated. However, there was a large Indian town just east of the Wabash River, Shawneetown. So the population in that area wasn't that depleted. The other thing is to describe them as hunter-gatherers is not very accurate. They had fields and orchards of nuts and fruit, and they were very largely depended upon this until the settlers disrupted the Indian agriculture, particularly cutting the orchards. So the situation isn't quite as you describe it. Thank you.
Well, I don't. You want to respond to that?
Well, I would like to respond to that because I think in my book I do make this point that there had been a rapid depopulation. But it's important to recognize that the depopulation had already occurred by the period that I'm interested in, and that certainly, as I said, is discussed. And the caller is correct that the introduction of diseases to which Indians had no immunity seems to have been an important factor in that. Another important factor, however, in the collapse of the Illinois Confederacy, for which the state is named and which had really dominated the state from the beginning of historic memory when the French first arrived here, was repeated and brutal attacks by other Indian tribes, particularly the Iroquois of New York and the Sioux from the Northwest. And they had, in fact, in that respect, been more allied than opposed by first the French and then later the British. It's interesting that the few Illinois Indians who survived in the state were primarily friendly to the United States. The Indians that we battled in the War of 1812, however, were all relatively recent newcomers to the state, and I think we have to separate this from the collapse of the Illinois population previously, which is, and the caller's quite right about that, from the Indian tribes who actually lived north of the line I indicated. Those were the Kickapoo, the Potawatomi, the Sauk. None of those tribes had been settled in Illinois for more than a couple generations at most, and they had forced themselves in, quite frankly, by force and violence. So while they were dealt with very severely and I think very callously and unfairly, it is also wrong to sentimentalize them and to realize that what they lost by unfair treaties they had gained by violence.
Other questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit about the Fort Dearborn Massacre, and it seems that actually if you look at people who died as a result of military action, that I think probably that particular event accounts for about a quarter, I think, of all of the people who were killed in Illinois in 1812. Do I have that right?
You know, that's a computation I've never made. I would say certainly the people killed by military action, loosely defined, would be probably
a couple hundred
at the most.
Yeah.
That was not uncommon. The battle deaths in the United States during the War of 1812, I forget the exact figure, but it's something in the area of 2,500. Was, I gather, about one-third of the in-service deaths from American troops. The sanitation was bad. They didn't even wash their hands before they operated, and living conditions were harsh.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, for that, just making the connection between that and any other significant battles other than this one that Zachary Taylor was involved in and what is around the Quad Cities. Were there other things that you would say, well, these were the top military engagements of the War of 1812 in the Illinois Territory?
Well, also in the Quad Cities area, and perhaps one of the more dramatic events of the war, and certainly something described in great detail in my book, was the Battle of Campbell's Island. Also in the Quad Cities area, and this was, in fact, a forerunner of Taylor's battle, this was the defeat of a relief column. If we can describe a column of boats, but five relief boats had been sent north towards Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, to relieve the American garrison there, and they ran into the Sauk Indians, who were initially friendly, but who had gained information that the Americans didn't have of the fall of Prairie du Chien, and who turned on them, and led to really quite a bloody battle, the destruction of one of the American gunboats, and quite a dramatic event. Mm-hmm. Also, I would say perhaps one of the central events of my book was the American effort to attack the Indian villages around in the area of Peoria, and this did lead to I would say probably the one and only surprise of an Indian village, something very difficult to accomplish during the course of the war, when Governor Ninian Edwards and Colonel William Russell led a force up from the Edwardsville area, surprised a Kickapoo village, and with significant slaughter. And the an adjunct of this was the burning and destruction of old French Peoria by a couple of companies of roughneck militiamen from southern Illinois who'd come up bearing supplies for Edwards, missed him, but did make their mark in history by burning down Peoria.
So I guess certainly one would have to say, though, that the effect of the war on the indigenous people was disastrous in the sense that eventually, even though there were perhaps some treaties negotiated between the Americans and the Indians, the Indians end up being pushed out.
Well, there's no doubt about that. There are Indian tribes and reservations in other states of the Midwest, and in Illinois there are none. So they were in fact pushed out, and this included even Indians who had been friendly, such as the Kaskaskia Indians of southwestern Illinois, who served alongside American troops as scouts and as brothers in arms, but didn't do them any good once it came time to move them west. The Indians were not so much militarily defeated as their morale was destroyed. This was, I think, recognized by many of the Indians in the state as sort of their last throw of the dice. After this, they had no real expectation of assistance from Britain, and I think no ability to stand on their own. And having given it their best, I think that they were more easy to move out. Mm-hmm. Within 3 years, the Potawatomi, who had been initially enemies but later friendly neutrals of the United States, had ceded all of their land south of the southern tip of Lake Michigan, and did it really in a spirit of despair. Mm.
Besides, we the name of William Henry Harrison came up, and maybe the most of people who would go on later to be very significant figures in national history, Zachary Taylor probably would be the one who would be the most important and the one who had the most significant activity here in this part of the country. Are there other people, other names that you think are particularly important that you'd want to say here with somebody who had some involvement in Illinois at this time, that then went on to greater significance in American history?
Well, you've mentioned two. Actually, three American presidents played a role in my story. One of them, of course, is Andrew Jackson, as colorful a character who's ever lived, and today, obviously, a very controversial one. Mm-hmm. A person that I think looms very large in my book, and that I hope I have given his due, was Governor Ninian Edwards, who from 1809 to 1818 was the only governor that the Illinois Territory had. And Edwards went on to be United States Senator, Ambassador to Mexico, later third governor of the state of Illinois. He had a long political career, and I think he is best known as for having filled all of these offices with a complete lack of distinction. He perhaps setting the trend for his successors. For instance, Edwards was really a sort of a time server in many ways, who avoided the major controversial issues of his day. One of the hot issues, obviously, between 1818 and 1824 was whether Illinois would be a slave or free state. Elections were fought over this. Riots were held over this. And it's impossible at this point to determine which side of the controversy, if any, Edwards was on. He kept out of it. It's not associated with any ideas. But I have argued that from 1811 to 1813, when he was superseded in command by a U.S. Army general, that Edwards really had the best years of his life, and he did show a devotion to duty and a moral courage, even if not always the best judgment, which does entitle him to, I think, kindly remembrance by the people of Illinois.
It sounds like, though, in some respect, that maybe he was successful precisely because he avoided taking positions that would have been difficult.
Well, you know the old joke about the politician who won't say which side of an issue he's going to be on, but when he does make up his mind, he'll be damn bitter about it. Edwards was perhaps a precursor of that phenomenon. But in this case, he did step up. I mean, it's interesting to note that Edwards' term ran out in the summer of 1812, and Illinois was so remote and so unimportant that apparently the Madison administration forgot to reappoint him. Certainly they didn't tell him whether he'd been reappointed. But Edwards, to his credit, and he was not in Illinois, and he was a Kentuckian, stayed at his post because he saw that the times were darkening, that somebody had to provide leadership in the territory, whether he was actually technically governor or not, and he, in fact, even pledged his own resources to induce militiamen to exist. So he showed a good deal of moral courage at a time when it was needed, and perhaps that makes his subsequent lack of principle more intriguing.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Gillum Ferguson, and we are talking about what you will find in his book, Illinois in the War of 1812. It's recently published by the University of Illinois Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. So this was primarily here a conflict between Indians and European settlers. Who were the important leaders on the Indian side?
The one who's most famous, and I perhaps should have mentioned him earlier, I mean, because I again, do try to give the Indians their due in this to the extent that sources permit it, was Black Hawk. Mm-hmm. Black Hawk was, as it's often pointed out, not a civil chief, but he was a war chief of the Sauk, meaning that it was not perhaps a formal position, but one who would lead parties to war because of his great prestige as a warrior. And this war and his participation in it really brought Black Hawk for the first time to the attention of the United States. Other Indians who I think loom fairly large in my story are Main Pock, M-A-I-N-P-O-C, but it's spelled in almost as many ways as there are possibilities in the literature of the time, who was a Pottawatomi war chief, very, very much opposed to the Americans, who had a reputation as a holy man and miracle worker as well as a warrior. And then perhaps his opposite number, Gomo, also a very important figure in my book, who was a Pottawatomi chief near whose village was at what's now Chillicothe, Illinois, just northeast of Peoria. And Gomo was, in a sense, opposite of Manpak as opposed to warrior. He was a born diplomat, and he rarely followed a straight line between two points, but his efforts were to maintain the independence of his people between two very powerful contending factions. So he was ultimately, as it turned out, drawn into the war.
Mm-hmm. The war lasts now 2 years. And so the Treaty of Ghent comes in 1814. So that was the official. And although there was some fighting that actually did continue after the treaty was concluded, and maybe, again, one of the things about that people might know about the Battle of New Orleans was that it took place actually after the treaty was signed.
It's interesting you should mention that, David. That's actually a common misconception because while the delegations had signed the treaty in Belgium, by its terms, it wasn't effective until ratified by Parliament in the case of Britain and the Senate in the case of the United States, and ratifications had been exchanged. So as of February 20th, when the ratifications were exchanged, the war was officially over. Though, as you point out, not all of the fighting. But in fact, actually, though the parties were both sort of trying to stand down to the extent that they could, the war was still very much in effect.
Yeah. So as you say, the primary significance for the War of 1812 in Illinois was the opening of territory for potential settlement. And there was, I think, just over that period of 2 years, or perhaps shortly after 1814, and then you get into the years not long after that, there was a very, very big jump in the numbers of settlers compared with what they were on the eve of the war.
Well, there was an explosive growth in the decades after 1820. The population of what was then the state of Illinois tripled every 10 years. But the war actually permitted the influx of settlers for in a couple of ways, but one of the most important was that it facilitated the surveying and sale of the public lands. Although there were over 12,000 people in Illinois at the outbreak of the war, and the number dipped as people evacuated to safer locations during the course of the war, only 200 to 300 of them were freeholders in the sense that they owned the ground on which they sat from ancient grants either by France or Britain or Virginia. So once the Indian threat had been reduced, in fact, substantially eliminated, surveyors were able to survey the system of townships and ranges, which is the basis of the Illinois property system. Until that time, someone could improve land, but he had no real assurance that he would ultimately be able to purchase it or own it, or that it would, in fact, at worst, be sold out under his feet to speculators who had more money. So this did permit the influx of settlers, which really, as Governor Edwards pointed out, would eventually reduce the Indians to statistical irrelevance and help to ease them out of the state.
Yeah. And when did Illinois become a state?
In 1818. Which is a mere 6 years after the outbreak of the War of 1812, when Illinois is still very much the remote and thinly settled frontier. And 6 years later, it was able to knock at the door of the Union and receive admission. And what had intervened was the War of 1812, which makes it all the more surprising that no one has ever studied this before.
Yeah. So I find myself wondering, really what we're talking about here is we're talking about a conflict between settlers and indigenous people. That's what within the context of this this larger war that was involved the United States and Britain. And so one wonders, would that kind of thing have happened anyway? And one would think that eventually Illinois would have become a state. So you really think that there's a good argument to make that perhaps that process would have been accelerated, or it happened in a way that it might not have had it not been for the fact that the United States and Great Britain were at war?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, unless you're asking me. What might have happened had there not been
well,
a war?
Well, that would have been a better way to ask the question, wouldn't it? Yes.
And in fact, without a control, it's impossible to say in any precise sense. But I can say that probably the process would have continued. As I said, the Indians were in population and economic decline, and it seems unlikely that we are going to that was going to. Exist in perpetuity, that we would have reached a point where the Indians would have continued to occupy this area in migratory villages while jet planes soared overhead between New York and Los Angeles. I mean, the handwriting was on the wall. The question is whether it had to be done so callously, and I would suggest, and one of the themes of my book is that it didn't. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I don't think that the Indian population could have sustained themselves in northern Illinois.
I talked earlier about the fact that here now this year, this is the bicentennial of the War of 1812, and that there will be observances probably in states where they have the means and where important things happen, you know, there will be observances. So you say if people in the state of Illinois would like to visit some places that have important associations with 1812, are there indeed places that they can go that you would say, yes, if you want to see something of the history of this time, this is where you go?
That's a good question. In terms of places with something to see, there have been some of the 1812-era forts have been restored or rebuilt. The caller from Crawford County mentioned Fort LaMotte in Palestine earlier, which has been rebuilt, and we have some idea of what a frontier fort looked like. And near Greenville, the local historians are rebuilding what's called Hill's Fort, the scene of some dramatic events in the War of 1812, including an ambush of U.S. Rangers down near Greenville. And then, of course, on the Ohio River at Metropolis, the perennial favorite in the longtime state park, Fort Massac, which has been rebuilt to the War of 1812 era. So those are places where you can, in a sense, see something. There are other places where there are monuments. There's a monument at Campbell's Island near Moline, marking the westernmost water battle of the War of 1812, with an inscription which gives the wrong date. So that's perhaps typical of the Forgotten War.
Mm-hmm. And also, I do want to mention that our guest here, Gillum Ferguson, in the weeks and months ahead, will be talking about the War of 1812, giving talks at a number of places around the state. He'll be in Decatur, Peoria, in Chicago, in Springfield, in Bloomington, in Effingham, in Edwardsville, in Alton, a lot of other places, and including, I think, in early May, the closest to Champaign-Urbana, you'll be out at Lake of the Woods at Mahomet.
I'll be visiting the Museum of the Grand Prairie, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Yeah. And if people are interested in finding out where our guest might be speaking, you can go to the website of the University of Illinois Press, which is the publisher of the book. And if you then look for information on the book, you can also find a schedule of some of the things that he's going to be doing there. So if you're interested, you're listening here around the state of Illinois, you can find some places where he'll be giving talks, and you can follow up on that. What's your takeaway here for people who are interested in this very question of, well, what was this all about here in the state of Illinois?
What I think it was about was a clash of civilizations. I mean, it's the white settlers, white and black, I should add, settlers came in from Kentucky and Indiana from the south. They met the Indian tribes who were moving in at that time from the north and moving into the last generation or two. Both of them wanted the same space, and what I think we should take away from it is that some accommodation should have been made, and in fact, the frontier ethos led to conflict and disaster, which might potentially have been avoided or at least minimized.
If you want to read more about this, you should look for the book. It's titled Illinois in the War of 1812. It is published by the University of Illinois Press by our guest, Gillum Ferguson. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.